This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean-Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, in for Terry Gross. And this is our year-end Fresh Air Critics Wrap-Up. Let's start with my picks for the best and worst television of the year. It was a couple weeks ago that I spoke with Terry. I can remember it now.
Hi, David. Happy holidays.
Hi. I'm so glad to be here.
So let's start with your top 10. You want to just start by running through the list?
Okay, except I always have to have a caveat. I don't know, this irritates
it's
you.
It's always something,
but
isn't it?
I did limit it to just 10, but there are so many good shows this year that I had to do it by saying, all right, I'm only going to do scripted comedy dramas, and I want to put the documentaries over in another spot, and I want to put a couple other shows in another spot so they don't take up my top 10.
Okay, so let's go with the top 10, and then we'll move on.
All right, the official top 10 of 2011. Number one, Breaking Bad on AMC.
Yay, okay.
Okay. it's all right, I can run through the whole list. You don't have to...
Hold your applause,
yes,
ladies and gentlemen.
Hold your applause until the end, or we'll never get through this list. It's such a good list. Number two is Homeland on Showtime. That's a first-year show. Number three is The Good Wife on CBS. That's a network show, broadcast television. So is number four, Modern Family on ABC. It's not that I'm rooting for broadcast television necessarily, but they're not on this list as much as cable. And then number five is Justified on FX. Number six is Dexter on Showtime. Number seven is another first-year show, American Horror Story on FX. Number eight is Curb Your Enthusiasm on HBO. Number nine is Louie on FX. And number 10 is True Blood on HBO.
Did you bring any clips with you to show us how good any of these shows are?
I brought one from Homeland. And it's not from the most recent, you know, season ending or even the one before that. So it's a perfect little clip to show how intense this program is and why I like it so much. So if you want to hear it,
set it up for us.
Okay, it's... Claire Danes plays Carrie, a CIA agent who thinks that the other star of the show, Damian Lewis as Brody, is actually a prisoner of war that has come back that's been flipped by Al-Qaeda and that he may have some designs about U.S.-based terrorism. So she thought that and then she didn't think that and now she thinks it again, but she's been in an explosion, she's in the hospital, and she's off her meds, and we already know that she's bipolar. And so she's trying to explain to her boss, Saul, who's played by Mandy Patinkin, what her theory is. And when you listen to her explain it, it's not just the drama of what she knows or what she fears, but of what's happening to her as a character.
The thing is, Saul, the Avenue here has methods and patterns and priorities. A single sniper? No, Avenue here doesn't do that. He never has. He never will. He goes big. He explodes. He maims en masse. We know that.
Slow down.
Well, facts are facts. And we have about a week, maybe less, to figure out the real target. Not this single shot to the president's spy novel 101.
Well, actually, that's the working theory.
Well, it's wrong. It's incomplete. Walker's not even critical. He's just a part, a piece, a pixel, a pawn of no importance. There is a bigger, pernicious, Abu Nazir-worthy plot out there, and we have little time. We have to code it, collide it, collapse it, contain it.
Lie down, Carrie. Doctor's coming.
Isn't that amazing? I mean, it sets up the drama of what's to come about the terrorist threat, but you're so worried about her. And he's so worried about her. It's so rooted in character that I love this show.
So let's get to your worst list.
Okay. Worst list, I'll do it from number five to number one. So we'll build in some exciting suspense. The number five is Charlie's Angels, the remake on ABC. And the second that you had a Buff Bosley, you knew you were in trouble with that show.
Who's Bosley?
Bosley. See, you're just upping your cred. Bosley in the original Charlie's Angels was like the sort of Pillsbury doughboy guy who hung around and was the non-sexual buddy who would drive the car and do things. Well, now he's, you know, a matinee idol kind of player. And it's like that's just really dumb. But to dissect Charlie's Angels on that level is to give it too much time. We've already given it too much time. Charlie's Angels, here, gone. Number four, Kim's fairy tale wedding, a Kardashian event. I don't think I have to explain why. But this TV show on E! Was two parts. It was 4 hours long. And Kim's marriage to Chris Humphries was 72 days. So I don't know how you do the math on that, but it's like you take 72 and then divide it again by six, and this TV show lasted, you know, maybe 1/300th as much as the marriage. I'm not sure about the math, but a waste of time. I'm talking about the TV show now, a waste of time. Number three, a new CW show that has already been canceled, started in the fall, called Hater, except it's not spelled H-A-T-E-R. It's spelled capital H, numeral 8. Capital R.
Well, okay.
Do you know the idea of this
one? No,
okay.
I don't.
See, I worry when I describe new ones that you think that I'm joking, but this is the premise. You take people on the internet who have written snarky things about celebrities, and then you take those celebrities and a camera crew, and you ambush the snarky person, and you have the celebrity try to charm them while the cameras are rolling so that they will like them.
Wow, who dreams this stuff up?
I don't know.
So name one celebrity or...
Gladly, because the one in the pilot was Snooki. So Snooki, yeah.
That's perfect. Someone who this kind of show created becomes a celebrity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So and to jump ahead to number two...
And like Snooki is really unfamiliar with people being snarky.
And... It's so good at being charming, too. It's just a trifecta with this show.
We're spending too much time on this one, too.
I know. Yeah. But the thing is, the number two show, the number two worst show is Jersey Shore. So Snooki, by being in Jersey Shore and in the pilot of Hater, is actually in, let me do the math correctly, what, 40% of my worst shows of 2011.
And number one?
Number one just came back this month. After a hiatus, sort of like I think of it like Locusts, like it went underground for several years and now it's emerged. Fear Factor on NBC. It was a horrible show the first time. It's a horrible show now. I mean, it's a more horrible show now because they're spending more money and they're upping the gross factor to try to get attention on the internet.
And I think to prove your point, you've brought a clip with you.
Yeah, this is host Joe Rogan explaining the rules, and all you have to do is just imagine a giant, clear, see-through glass vat with a red liquid in it. And here we go.
Inside this tank is over 3,000 gallons of cow's blood.
I just got chills.
You and your partner will be bound together by the wrists, and you will alternate dunking into that tank to retrieve these cow hearts.
Ew. Oh my God.
One at a time, you will alternate dunking down into that tank, retrieving a cow heart, and then stuffing it into your partner's mouth.
What?
Who will then attempt to spit it into that box. The team that transfers the least amount of cow hearts in 3 minutes will be eliminated today.
I'm sorry.
No, I'm going to let this run.
Oh, God. That's so ridiculous.
Sometimes my job is pretty easy, don't you think?
And is it part of your job to make sure you watch these shows?
I had to watch the first 2 hours to see what they had done to Fear Factor in the interim. If suddenly it had somehow turned into Omnibus, you know, I wanted to be prepared. But now that I've seen those first 2 hours, I think that I can move on to other things. I'm so glad of your reaction to that.
For anyone tuning in wondering what is happening to Fresh Air, we're talking about the best and worst television shows of the year. That was an example of the worst. And with me is our TV critic, David Bianculli. So let's move on. Your 10 best list was all scripted television. So what about news? What's happening in news this year? What do you think were some of the high points in terms of coverage and regular programs?
Well, there's interesting stuff in news both in terms of the networks seem to be deciding, not all of them, but that people want serious news. And so they're making more choices. CBS Evening News, now that Katie Couric is gone, is trying to be a little bit more serious. In January, they launch a morning show where they're taking Charlie Rose as a new host and Gail King. Now,
Oprah's good friend.
Yes, Oprah's good friend. I don't know that that's a really good fit. It doesn't seem to make sense to me, but I'll wait and see if that works. It looks to me as though Charlie Rose will get all the serious things and Gail will get the rest. And I don't know if that's the way they plan it. But they're at least saying for the morning show audience, today is light and fluffy with a mix of news. Good Morning America is the same thing. So they're going to go more serious. So there's a try for that sort of thing. But still, I find the best analysis of news to be on a comedy program. You know, I mean, I still think 60 Minutes is a great program. And were I to have a top 10 that included news programs, 60 Minutes would probably be on it. But also vying for my top 10 would be The Colbert Report and Daily Show with Jon Stewart. And that's 30% of my top 10. So I'm just shoving the news things over to the side, if you'll let me.
So Colbert and Stewart belong in your top 10, and you're just subdividing it.
Yes, I'm just saying, okay, those guys – and it's a different sort of thing that those programs do, so I will put them over to the side. But I'm not saying that they just do the best comedy take on the news. Many times they do the best take on the news. And I actually have an example
if you
want to hear it.
Absolutely.
This is Jon Stewart on The Daily Show right as the Penn State scandal was breaking. And he started off giving his opinion about what should have happened at the time of the alleged event occurred. Then he played a clip of Penn State students taking to the streets to defend, you know, Coach Joe Paterno. And then he comes back with really what is an editorial.
Our school went in support of Joe Pa. We think it's absolutely ridiculous that he got fired over this sort of situation.
I don't want to jump to conclusions here, but it appears the street riot is in response to Coach Paterno's firing. See, I get that it's probably hard for you to believe that this guy you think is infallible and this program you think is sacred could hide such heinous activities, but there is some precedent for that. Yeah. And just like with the Catholic Church, no one's trying to take away your religion, in this case football. They're just trying to bring some accountability to a pope and some of his cardinals who So don't worry. On Saturday, you'll still get to go to services against Nebraska. No one's going to take that away because obviously you're young, and that would be a traumatic experience, and we wouldn't want that memory to scar you for life. We'll be right back.
Isn't that wonderful? You know, I'm a student of Mark Twain, and there are times, and I do not want to overinflate Jon Stewart, but when he's saying something really strong, even though it's humor, that you can hear where his heart is and where his anger is.
It's also so hard to take, you know, a child sex abuse story and find any humor in it. He knows where the humor is and how to find it without being
distasteful.
Thank you.
Yeah. But also, he knows when not to go for the laugh. You know, I mean, at the end of that particular program, he actually apologized. He said, because, you know, maybe it wasn't that funny a show, but it isn't that funny a topic. And I'm paraphrasing. But there are so many days where I will watch Colbert or I will watch Stewart, and it's not only a half hour and then an hour well spent, but I feel like, thank goodness somebody is watching television and politics and reality the same way I am.
Well, with me is David Bianculli, Fresh Air's TV critic, and we're looking at the year in television. David, did you have a favorite TV moment of the year?
Oh, I do. But I don't think this is going to be anybody else's TV moment. Now, I'm used to liking obscure things, but this is just so personal. This is my favorite moment of 2011. I don't expect it to be anybody else's. I didn't know it was coming. So imagine you're me, as horrifying as that may be, and you're watching television live, and this scene comes up on Parks and Recreation. It is set in a public radio control room where Dan Castellaneta is playing a public radio host interviewing Amy Poehler, who plays Leslie Knope on Parks and Recreation. about her new book.
Leslie, could one say that a book is nothing more than a painting of words, which are the notes on the tapestry of the greatest film ever sculpted?
One could say that. But should one?
Join us next week when David B. and Cooley will be filling in for Richard Chang Jefferson, who will be filling in for me. Leslie, would you like to take us out?
Okay. Please enjoy a song from the lesbian Afro-Norwegian funk duo Nefertiti's Fjord. Oh, wow. They are terrible.
Oh, yes, they're quite awful. But they are lesbians, so...
So, David, what was your reaction when you heard that the first time?
I was stunned at hearing my own name, but then it just kept getting funnier. I mean, as public radio parodies go, that was pretty much spot on in my critical eye. So I just loved that thing.
Well, David, it's been great to talk about the year in television with you.
All right, thanks. You know how much I love being here and how proud I am to be associated with Fresh Air.
Oh,
so thanks.
Ditto, we love having you. Thank you so much.
Thanks a lot.
And Happy New Year.
You too. Terry and I spoke in late December. Our rock critic, Ken Tucker, has been listening and re-listening to a lot of the music he's reviewed for Fresh Air over the past year. And he's come up with a best-of list that mixes albums, individual songs, and a book. He's included some music he thinks he underrated the first time around, as well as some music he never reviewed for us.
There's a fire starting in my heart, reaching a fever pitch, and it's bringing me out the dark. Finally, I can see you crystal clear. Go ahead and sell me out, and I'll lay your bed.
If any one musician held center stage in pop music this year, it was probably Adele. The British singer, whose album 21 was one of the best-selling collections of the year, one of the most highly praised by critics, and I would dare say reached the widest range of listeners. That last element has increasingly become less important in compiling a year-end best list. Sales figures and broad demographics don't mean much, quality-wise, in a music industry that's become so splintered into genres and cults. You may say you love pop music, but someone who likes, say, Beyoncé may never listen to Dear Tick. And Dear Tick fans would likely think that Paul Simon is way uncool. Yet Simon's album, So Beautiful or So What, is an album that I underrated when I first reviewed it here. The more I listened to it, the richer its rewards became.
I've been working on my rewrite, that's right. I'm gonna change the ending. Gonna throw away my title and toss it in the trash. Every minute after midnight, all the time I'm spending, it's just for working on my rewrite, that's right. And I'm gonna turn it into cash. I've been working at the...
This was a very strong year for country music, with fine albums ranging from a veteran performer such as Dolly Parton to a new act like the Pistol Annies. The Annies are a trio whose guardian angel is Miranda Lambert. She's one of its three singers in this side project. I reviewed Miranda Lambert's album, For the Record, for Fresh Air, but only recently got into the Pistol Annies album, Hell on Heels, and I think it's as good as any country album out there. There's also another definitely non-country act that I didn't get around to reviewing, Tune Yards, and the intricate pop-rock clatter Tune Yards founder Merrill Garbus makes on the album Who Kill. It kept coming back around on my playlist so often that it worked its way into my top 10.
Now that everything is gone. okay now that everything is gonna be alright. What if, baby, I cannot see the sound? What if, baby, I cannot hear the light? Now that everything is gonna be okay now that everything is gonna be alright. What if, baby, I cannot see the sound? What if, baby, I cannot hear the light? What's that about? What's that about? What's that about? What's that about? Now that everything is gonna be okay. Now that everything is gonna be alright. What if, baby, I cannot see the sound? What if, baby, I cannot hear the light? Now that everything is gonna be okay. Now that everything is gonna be alright. What if, baby, I cannot see the sound? What if, baby, I cannot hear the light? I was born to do it. My daddy had enough, so I put my back into it. That man was born to do it too. We didn't have enough, so we cannot sing for you. Ha!
I wouldn't say there were any big, obvious trends in 2011 pop. It was a Lady Gaga slash Adele kind of year. But working within an R&B tradition proved very fruitful, not only for Adele, but also for a singer such as Anthony Hamilton on his rich new album Back to Love, and Rafael Sadiq's continually amazing revitalizations of soul music on the collection Stone Rollin'.
Listen.
If one voice defined the year for me, it was that of John McCauley, singer for the band Deer Tick and part of a small-time supergroup called Middle Brother. Both the Middle Brother album and Deer Tick's Divine Providence were examples of rock and roll powered by McCauley's raw, jagged, yet sensitive and soulful vocals. My 10 best list also includes a book, Everything is an Afterthought, The Life and Writings of Paul Nelson by Kevin Avery. Nelson, who died in 2006 at age 69, was part of the first generation of rock critics, instrumental in bringing attention to musicians including Bob Dylan, Jackson Brown, the New York Dolls, and Warren Zevon. The book is both an anthology of his best writing and a tragic recounting of a life that shut down too soon. Like you, I find my music in various ways, on albums, on the internet, through books. It was a challenge and a pleasure to pick through such a ripe year as this one proved to be.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large at Entertainment Weekly. You can listen to a song from each of the albums he reviewed on our website, freshair.npr.org. You'll also find links to all of Ken's reviews from the whole year. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, says that 2011 was a banner year for fiction and especially for first-time novelists. That's why her Best Books of the Year list is dominated by fiction. But a couple of nonfiction titles make the cut as well.
This was a year of terrific first novels, some of them written by writers so young, their wisdom teeth probably haven't had time to become impacted yet. Swamplandia, a debut novel by 30-year-old Karen Russell, is my absolute favorite of these dazzlers. Set in the Florida Everglades at a rundown alligator wrestling theme park, Swamplandia tells the story of 13-year-old Ava Bigtree, who saves her economically struggling family from sinking down into the primordial ooze. It's Ava's cocky, Huck Finn-sized voice that carries this story forward into the realm of literary magic. Another standout debut novel, Open City, by 30-somethinger Teju Cole, is set a world apart from palm trees and swamp things. Cole's novel follows a despondent young Nigerian doctor, a resident in psychiatry, as he wanders around Manhattan, thinking about the ghosts of Dutch settlers and encountering the city's newer immigrants from China and Africa. Open City resurrects that most elemental of all New York plots, that is, The Tale of a Walker in the City. Amy Waldman's debut novel, The Submission, is that rare animal, a political novel that's also elegantly written. It imagines the angry fallout when a jury chooses an anonymous design for a 9/11 memorial at Ground Zero, and the architect turns out to be Muslim American. Although that premise may sound suspiciously high concept, The Submission ventures far beyond the contrived and probes the stress fractures of democracy. The Art of Fielding, a striking debut novel by Chad Harbach, is a baseball novel cross-pollinated with an academic novel, all wrapped up in a coming-of-age novel. Any novel that can make me care about the slowest game ever invented by man is a literary home run worth applauding. Now it's time to turn to wonderful novels written by writers who've been around the block a few times. The Illumination by Kevin Brockmeyer is an unnerving fantasy about how we would respond if we could actually see each other's wounds, physical and emotional, glowing through our bodies. It also contains some of the most affecting everyday love letters any writer has ever dreamt up. Another compelling spiritual fantasy of sorts was brought out this year by Tom Perata. The Leftovers, Riley looks at some folks left behind in suburbia after the rapture has happened. The Marriage Plot by Jeffrey Eugenides is a deft academic novel that spins out a romance as it merrily eviscerates the literary theory invasion of the 1980s in English departments throughout the land. Readers go deep into another treacherous terrain, the Amazonian rainforest, in Ann Patchett's State of Wonder, an ingenious female twist on the Heart of Darkness plot. Finally, two literary triumphs of contrasting proportions round out my best fiction list. Dennis Johnson's spare and extraordinary novella, Train Dreams, transports us deep into the landscape of American mythology stripped of heroics. Set in 1920, it evokes the quiet, harsh life of those solitary men who built the railroads and felled the trees. David Foster Wallace's posthumously published unfinished novel, The Pale King, clocks in at over 500 densely printed pages. No matter. Every few paragraphs or so, a sentence will bubble to the surface that's so genuine, it makes you realize how artificial, by comparison, so much other fiction is. The Pale King, which is ostensibly about an IRS agent and his office mates, is an epic about work, its dullness, and its demands. I've just named 10 books in this best books list, and I haven't even mentioned any nonfiction yet. So let me quickly squeeze in two unforgettable works of nonfiction that came out this year. Adam Hochschild's To End All Wars is a pensive narrative history of the pacifist resistance to World War I. Hochschild says that by conflict's end, more than 20,000 British men of military age refused the draft. His account also investigates the larger moral question of how conventional wisdom is formed and what it takes to stand up against it. Stephen Greenblatt's The Swerve, which just won the National Book Award, unearths the riveting story of an Italian book hunter named Poggio Bracciolini, who one fateful day in 1417 stumbled across the sole surviving copy of the Roman poet Lucretius's work On the Nature of Things. It was a discovery, Greenblatt says, that would kickstart the Renaissance and usher in all manner of thought that we consider modern. The Swerve makes readers appreciate the fragility of cultural inheritance and the need to safeguard books, especially the good ones, from the ubiquitous dust of neglect and casual indifference.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Let's finish our 2011 wrap-up with our film critic, David Edelstein. Terry spoke with him earlier in December and got his thoughts about the year in film, as well as which holiday movies are worth catching this season.
David Edelstein, good to talk with you again. Thank you for coming by with your 10 best list. And let's start with the big drama. Why don't you start with the reading of the list?
Well, I just want to say that there's no best film this year. This is in alphabetical order, you know, because I liked all these movies. I loved some of them. I just couldn't pick a best. It wasn't that kind of year. Some years something just leaps out at you. Last year was Winter's Bone. This year, I don't know. I think Bianculli had it a lot better again this year.
You mean you think TV was better than radio? Movies?
There was nothing on the big screen with the intensity of the last four or five episodes of Breaking Bad. I really feel like I was at the wrong medium this year. But I came up with a lot of films that I loved, and so here they are in alphabetical order. And then there's one at the end that I want to talk about specially.
Okay.
All right, The Adventures of Tintin, Steven Spielberg's 3D animated. Beginners, I guess if I had to choose, this is the movie that I probably loved the most, Mike Mills's melancholy and madcap romantic drama. Coriolanus, that had a one-week run in New York and L.A. to qualify for the Academy Awards. It's Ralph Fiennes's adaptation of Shakespeare's play, kind of by way of The Hurt Locker. Alexander Payne's The Descendants is number four. Gainsbourg, A Heroic Life, great inventive Serge Gainsbourg-inspired biopic. Then a documentary I saw at the very last minute called Hell and Back Again by a filmmaker named Dan Fong Dennis, which cuts back and forth between a sergeant in Afghanistan leading his men and at home when after he's been very, very severely wounded. Another documentary is next, Into the Abyss, Werner Herzog's second documentary of the year and my favorite, which I think, you know, earns its comparisons to In Cold Blood. Margin Call comes next, the view from the 1%, a great business melodrama. Mysteries of Lisbon, Raul Ruiz's final film. He died a week after its U.S. release, and in fact, he died the very day that my review of this film aired on Fresh Air. And finally, another Steven Spielberg film, War Horse, his World War I epic.
Now, you said you wanted to save some time to talk about one film in particular.
On this very show, I described Lars von Trier's Melancholia as a masterly film. I think I called it a hateful masterpiece. And I'm not somebody who throws around words like that and then doesn't follow up on my 10 best list. I put it down on my list and I just couldn't do it. It is such a hateful film. It's the work of a nihilistic annihilist. For Lars von Trier, the world, when it ends, is well lost. Capitalism has poisoned it, and families are useless. And the heroine, the protagonist of the movie, played by Kirsten Dunst, is so utterly hateful that she's really quite happy that everything is going to hell. And I guess when one chooses, you know, the things that one loves and one wants to recommend, it's a very difficult question. Can you love a film? Can you recommend a film that highly, that peddles a worldview that you find so utterly hateful, even poisonous? I don't know the answer to that. I struggled with it. That's why it's my little asterisk.
So, David, what were some of your favorite performances of the year?
Oh, you know, there were so many. I should say that I walked into the latest Meryl Streep tour de force, The Iron Lady, with all my defenses up. I was not going to fall for another of her, you know, burbling, you know, fancy accent, amazing transformation performances. I was going to see through her virtuosity. No siree, bub. You know, you weren't going to get me, Streep. Well, you know, it took about 5 minutes, and then I was just on my knees. What she can do...
She's playing Margaret Thatcher in this.
Yes, the Iron Lady, Margaret Thatcher. See, it's really interesting because there's mimicry, and there's a kind of mimicry that by perfectly replicating the voice and the rhythm of the speech, a really great actor can almost get into the mind of the character. It's the same thing with her Julia Child. Once she gets the music of the character, then she gets how the mind works. And once she gets how the mind works, she gets how the body works. And then she puts it all together. It's such a riveting performance. And the film is really not bad at all. It doesn't really take too much of a stand on whether Thatcher was right or wrong in her policies. But it certainly shows you, you know, where they came out, how they came out of her in the form that they did. It's a great, great performance. Another performance that you'll hear a lot of talk about is Janet McTeer in this film Albert Nobbs, which is by Rodrigo Garcia. It's having a brief run to qualify for the Academy Awards. She plays a woman who moves through the world in disguise as a man, which is, in fact, Albert Nobbs, the hero slash heroine, played by Glenn Close, is also in the same position. And it's this beautiful movie about women, you know, in a very hostile, male-dominated world, having to kind of band together, with the, having to adopt these personae that on one level are very alien, but on another level allow them to operate in society. And I think it's a very, very moving film. I loved Amy Ryan in Win Win and Paul Giamatti. I loved this woman, Olivia Colman, in this really hideously depressing film called Tyrannosaurus.
You know, it's interesting. You're naming a lot of actresses, which is great because there's so many years where there are hardly any good roles for actresses.
It was much harder. It's much harder this year to think of actors' performances I'm very excited about. I loved Brad Pitt in Moneyball and in Tree of Life. But, you know, those are delightful star turns in which he goes a little bit further than he usually does. But is it the kind of thing that turns me into this babbling stage door Johnny, which is what I love when you see a performance that puts you over the moon? I don't think so, maybe. But I did love Christopher Plummer in Beginners. Plummer, you know, has been described as this saturnine, glowering actor, often plays villains, and playing a man who comes out of the closet at age 75, and even though he's dying from cancer in the film, it's the lightest performance, the least mysterious, the happiest. He seems to get younger on screen in front of your eyes, and it's wonderful to see an actor like Christopher Plummer, who's done so many beautiful things on, you know, in early television, in the theater and in film, really, really come into his own, really, really get a pedestal like that. And it's a lovely movie, too.
Movies take a long time to make, so it's not easy for them to really capture the moment, to really, like, get the zeitgeist. How do they do this year in reflecting some of American culture preoccupations?
Well, apocalypse is in the air. La la. There's just a vibe in the culture. That our way of life is ending, and whether that's climate change, as suggested in the movie, which I liked very much, Take Shelter, or world financial collapse, as suggested in Margin Call, or a plague spread with the help of globalization and contagion. By the way, I heard an expert talking about that on Fresh Air, and I nearly went into bed and crawled under the covers and said, what's the use? I
mean, that was not the goal of the interview, David.
Oh, sorry. Well, or chimpanzees taking over in Rise of the Planet of the Apes, or Lars von Trier blowing everything up because he hates us all. It's for whatever reason, you know, it's sort of like pick your reason why the world is going to end or the way of life is going to end. I think one reason Occupy Wall Street, if I can play political pundit here, seems so unexpected, is that the culture has been telling us in all kinds of ways in the last few years that collective action is hopeless. And here, you know, I can't wait to see the mindset of Occupy Wall Street percolate down into movies, because right now, I'm not saying that movies haven't always been fascinated with the idea of apocalypse. I'm just saying that not in so many bloody different ways.
So, David, let's talk about holiday movies, and maybe you can single out a couple that you think are really worth seeing and a couple that you think should actually be avoided.
Well, Tintin and War Horse are both on my 10 best list, and Tintin is everything that you dreamed of seeing Spielberg do. He is liberated from the forces of gravity by animation. And so he's able to do everything he did in Indiana Jones, but by a factor of 10. You've just never seen a sort of Rube Goldberg slapstick poetry like you see in this movie. It really is one long chase. It was one of these situations where my face literally hurt from grinning at the end of those 2 hours. His other film, War Horse, is based on a children's book, a very good one, that follows a horse through what is still one of the most senseless wars ever fought, World War I. And the horse has many different masters. Most of them, many of them die in very kind of random and hideous ways. The film has been accused of sentimentality, but you know the sentimentality is in the context of this horrible carnage and atrocity. I'm not saying that the film is like Saving Private Ryan. It still is something that you could take a 12 or a 13 year old to see. The other movie, Mission Impossible, Ghost Protocol, is the first live-action film by Brad Bird, who has, who it turns out is a filmmaker first and an animator second. It is so wildly, wonderfully kinetic. Finally, a Mission Impossible film that's actually about a team of people as opposed to Tom Cruise as the lone wolf James Bond figure going out on his own.
What should we avoid?
What should we avoid? Well, you know, actually, I'm very happy to say there is nothing out there right now that I would say steer clear of. I think Sherlock Holmes, the new Sherlock Holmes movie, Game of Shadows, is very bad. It's not offensively bad. It's worth seeing for Jared Harris's Professor Moriarty, who is very... it's a very sour, bitter, kind of chillingly small performance. I've always thought Jared Harris carried this kind of anger in him because his father was such a bon vivant, such a handsome, rakish leading man, and you know
that would
Jared,
be Richard Harris.
Yes, and Jared Harris was always sort of smaller in stature and kind of pockmarked and a wonderful actor, but a very, very different kind of actor. And I think when he interacts with Robert Downey Jr., who is very much in this sort of capering, fruity Richard Harris mode as Sherlock Holmes, I just saw this little glint that made me think, you know what? He sees his father in this fop. And that makes those scenes between Moriarty and Holmes actually very compelling. The rest of the movie is just a shambles. It's very inelegant and overbearing, and it's like Richard Lester's Three Musketeers, but without the kind of prankish wit that Richard Lester brought to it. So I guess I would avoid that. The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, very, very eagerly anticipated. I'm not a fan in particular of Stieg Larsson or his English translator, but the film is very effective at what it does. If you believe, as Larsson genuinely did, that the world is full of neo-Nazi rapist predators that are, you know, lurking around every corner, that are ready to do vile things to you, and you want to identify with this extremely damaged, heavily pierced young woman as she takes grisly revenge on them through her computer savvy and her wits, then the film is very gratifying. I mean, it's a very primitive fantasy, but I think it touches a lot of people. And the film by David Fincher, he's a very cruel director, and he does not flinch from any of the horrible things he's showing you. And I think the film, you know, it does pay off. It does deliver.
Did you see the original film adaptation, the Swedish one?
Yes, I did. And that seemed much more like what it was, which is a made-for-television movie. But it had this extraordinary performance by Noomi Rapace in it as Lisbeth Salander. It's very interesting to watch Noomi Rapace's Lisbeth Salander versus Mara Rooney's Lisbeth Salander, because with Noomi Rapace, just the anger is pouring off her. I mean, there are times when she looks like she's all pierced and she has a mohawk and she looks like some sort of savage warrior. She's so furious at what the world has done to her. Whereas Mara Rooney's approach is to play it very, very still, almost as if she's wearing a kind of mask, and then at certain key moments suddenly burst out into something angry and nail somebody, and then kind of go back to being very, very still. It's very interesting. I didn't quite buy it in the way that I bought Noomi Rapace's performance, but it's certainly, you're certainly not seeing the same thing over again. And Daniel Craig is wonderful in the film too. He's very likable, and he seems to relish the idea of playing someone who isn't James Bond and who actually feels an enormous amount of fear and is not particularly resourceful when faced with some, you know, malevolent threat.
Well, David, I want to thank you for talking about the year in film with us. I wish you happy holidays. It's always good to talk with you.
Oh, I love it. Thank you so much, Terry, and thank you so much for this wonderful job and being on this wonderful program.
Oh, thanks. It's great to have you.
Okay.
Happy holidays.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You'll find his Best of the Year list on our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Sharrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Melody Kramer is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley. Finally, let's hear some of the voices that made Fresh Air great in 2011. From all of us here, have a happy new year.
Tina Fey cheated. Anyone who has ever seen an old picture of her can see she has had 100% plastic surgery. She only wished she could ever be as beautiful as Sarah Palin.
It was incredible realizing that on a sheet of paper, I can write down an equation which summarized almost all physical knowledge.
That's really your job as an interpreter, to discover what is the way in. Is this spoken word? Do I growl this? Do I eliminate all my growl and try and do it like a younger man?
I'm looking at 13, 14, 15-year-old men and women dying on the streets of Chicago.
I cry a lot because I miss people. I cry a lot because they die and I can't stop them. They leave me, and I love them more.
You could hear the floors hitting the other floors and the sound of twisting steel all around you. So I dove for the stairway, and I just covered up as best I could.
I cannot say, all right, we need to tone down politics in this country and our language. I'm happy to do it in all circumstances, except when it's really true.
There is no sweeter feeling than when you throw the perfect punch, because you get this little tingling sensation that shoots up and down your arm to let you know that you've hit the jackpot.
If you make a small cut, it could
lie. Let me stop there. You're talking about cutting yourself.
Yeah.
With a razor.
Mm-hmm. Who the do you think you are? You're not a movie star. You're nothing.
You're my brother, and I love you, and I will always love you. Because I know you're going to die soon.
You know, I could watch an episode of Jerry Seinfeld, and by the end, I'm just walking around my house. You know, I'm talking like Jerry Seinfeld. What is that? What are you doing? Who is there? What's going on?
Twitter is not useful. Twitter is the Seinfeld of the internet. It's a service about nothing.
I'm not the most popular girl in town, yet Tommy keeps dating me. Is it because of love or pity?